From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. I'm here while Terry Gross is on vacation. Today, I speak with Robert Parrish. He started out in Hollywood in the Our Gang comedies and Charlie Chaplin's City Lights, and he became a director and Oscar-winning editor. I also speak with Peter Phillips, director of the Talis Scholars. They bring heaven to earth through their interpretations of Renaissance choral works. New Orleans pianist Mac Rebenek performs some other timeless music, three pieces by Louis Armstrong. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews the Broadway revival of Cole Porter's hit musical, Anything Goes. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. When Robert Parrish grew up in Los Angeles in the early 1920s, the Hollywood studio lots were his playground. As a child, he was an actor in many films, including Charlie Chaplin's City Lights and the Our Gang comedies. Director John Ford became his mentor. Parrish acted in Ford's films, learned sound and film editing under his wing, and later worked on some of the director's greatest films, such as The Grapes of Wrath. During World War II, Parrish and Ford made films for the U.S. Intelligence Agency, the Office of Strategic Services. Robert Parrish became one of Hollywood's top film editors. He won an Academy Award for his work on Body and Soul in 1947. He worked with many of Hollywood's most illustrious stars. He directed Rita Hayworth in the film Fire Down Below, joined Ernest Hemingway at the bullfights in Spain, and he once served as Mae West's bodyguard. Parrish has written a two-volume memoir of his Hollywood days, Growing Up in Hollywood, and the newly published Hollywood Doesn't Live Here Anymore. I spoke with him at the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked him about the first movie he remembers seeing.
First movie was a Doug Fairbanks picture, The Black Pirate, and I saw it in Columbus, Georgia, where I grew up, and I was about 6 or 8 years old, I think. And I never forgot it.
Did it give you a sense of what the pictures were going to be like?
Well, it never occurred to me that I'd be involved in pictures in any way. I only wanted to be involved in the one that I was looking at. And in that one, Doug Fairbanks was standing on a sail of a sailing boat, a spar, way up above the deck of the boat. And he pulled out a knife and put it in his mouth for a minute, and smiled down at the people below. Then he took it out of his mouth and he jumped onto the sail and put the knife into the sail and rowed down and did away with the pirates that were on the deck. I never forgot it.
Now, you moved to Hollywood from Georgia, and the Hollywood lots became your playground. Did your parents mind that, or did they think of it as an education for you?
Well, I don't think they minded it because as soon as there were four kids in the family, and this family wasn't very well off, and my father traveled, he wasn't home a lot. And so shortly after we got there, we began to work and became a source of income for the family. And so I don't think they minded it at all. We worked as extras, as child extras, and then as we grew older, we worked at and the swing gang on the back lots and things like that. We became part of the industry.
What was your first confrontation with the Hollywood star system?
Oh, I guess the one that was the most memorable was a man came into the school that I was going to, the grammar school, and asked who wanted to work in a picture with Charlie Chaplin. Well, I certainly knew who he was. And I held up my hand, and then they said, well, only boys, because some girls held up their hands, too. And he said, only boys that can shoot a pea shooter. So they eliminated all but two of us and took us over to Charlie Chaplin's studio and introduced us to Mr. Chaplin. And I watched him direct some parts of this movie, which was called City Lights. And then when it came around to tell us what to do, or to these two boys were going to shoot a pea shooter at him. He did it for so long that we were finally bored with it. But he wanted to do it himself. He wanted to do everything himself. He would, he would be the boys shooting the pea shooter, and he'd run out to the middle of the street and put his hand on his head and pretend that he was hit with a pea shooter.
You mean he wanted to play all the parts?
He wanted to play all the parts. He wanted to do everything. And so it was, finally, he reluctantly said to Raleigh Totherow, the cameraman, well, I guess we better shoot it. And he always said that after he had done the parts for the leading lady, the heavy, the kids in the street, and he was reluctant to finally say, well, I guess we have to let them do it now. That's what I remember about meeting a big star.
Yeah, about the style of his directing, too.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You really made the rounds as a child extra. You worked with Chaplin and Douglas Fairbanks, and then you got picked for Our Gang.
Yes. Our Gang, they had four or five, maybe six kids that were stars in Our Gang. In my time, the fat boy was Joe Cobb, and the little black boy was Farina. And there was a little girl named Mary Kornman and Mickey Daniels. But they were the main actors in Our Gang. Then they had a backup group for each one of these kids in case they got sick or they had trouble with their mothers or whatever. And or we would also, I was chosen as one of the backup kids. And we would be the enemy team if it was a football game or if they needed someone for Joe Cobb to hit with a ball-peen hammer, we would be the ones. And so, but they put us under contract, and I stayed there for about a year.
You know, the kids, as I look back on it now, always seem to have this sort of set responses to certain kinds of things. Did you do that spontaneously, or did they teach you that stuff?
No, they taught it to us. When they had the interview, the director, Robert McGowan, who was a very dour man, he never laughed at all at anything. I never saw him laugh. He wore a derby, he had a pockmarked face, and he came into this room where we were going to be interviewed. There were about 15 kids there, and they wanted five. And he said, now, look here, you kids, listen to me. I'm going to show you some things you're going to have to do if you work in Our Gang. And if you can do them, you'll work in Our Gang. And if you can't, you're out. You got it? And we were kids at some at 6 years old or something. He said, the first thing I'm going to tell you is how to do a do. And so we watched, and he then held his mouth open and said, do, and shook his head. And he said, when I tell you to do a do, that's what I want. You got it? And so we kind of said yes. And he said, all right, let's see all of you do it. So he said, do it. And we all did it. And he eliminated seven of the kids right away. He said, you can't do do's. Then he said, now we're going to go to double do's, which is the same as a single do, except that you shake your head twice. You go do, do. And then one of them was called a flip-flop. And one was called a butterfly wings, which is, say you did get hit with a stick or you stood up straight and put your hands across your chest so that your fingers showed in the back and flipped them like a butterfly and then fell on the floor. And he was very impressed with the way I did that. And he said, you're all right, kid, you're going to be one of them. He said, I never saw anybody do a butterfly that good the first time. So his direction for the year after that was he would point or hold up four fingers or two fingers, and the kids, they had this language going.
Yeah, he would signal you.
Oh, sure.
Did you get the sense that he liked kids?
Not particularly. I never felt any particular warmth for him. Yeah. I once saw a picture of him. I did see a picture of him smiling once with Mickey Daniels. And so I guess he had Mickey Daniels on his shoulders and seemed to be liking him. But it was a routine, more or less. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of fun off between shooting.
Yeah,
the kids playing and so on.
A director, film editor, and actor Robert Parrish is my guest. Weren't you also an extra on the sinking of the Titanic movie?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is that the one where they tried to get you to cry?
Yes, as the Titanic was going down, Charles Boyer and the leading people were involved in some certain things, but other people had to line up along the deck, at the rail, and Frank Borzegi was the director, and we were supposed to sing Nearer My God to Thee, and then cry. And so he tried, I saw he was trying people out to see if they could cry. And so I sneaked off into the men's room where they had some Lux soap. Lux soap was in all the studios of men's room and ladies' rooms. They had a contract for Lux soap. And I put some Lux soap under my fingernails. And when it came to me and they pointed to me, I had put some soap in my eyes and it made me cry. So I was hired and given a little bit part in it.
So they loved you too there.
Yes, sure. Now, my mother had told me, always say yes. Whatever they, I don't care what they ask you, you say yes. And if they ask you if you have a gray suit and you don't, I'll make one for you the night before you go to work.
You mean whether you could do it or not?
Always,
say yes.
Always, just say yes.
Did you get in trouble when they found out you couldn't?
Quite often. Well, they asked me if I could cry, and I couldn't cry, but I found a way to do it. I had said yes, I could cry. That's the first thing they asked when they phoned and asked us to come for the interview.
You finally got sort of a full job working in the cutter's room and working with sound editing and negatives and that kind of thing. Did that help you later on when you became a director, having had that experience?
Oh, yes. At that particular time in the industry, it's changed, of course, since. For example, when sound came in, the word was more important than the mechanics of cutting, but the word around Hollywood was that cutters make good directors, and quite often they would say the cutter actually makes the picture. And I used to say that until I became a director, and then I said it's nonsense. But yes, I did work as a sound effects editor and a music editor, and then finally as a feature picture editor.
Now, isn't that where you met John Ford, the director, when you were working as a cutter?
No, I met John Ford when I was a little boy, and he was directing a picture called Mother McCree, and I was an extra in a schoolroom or something, and he liked to hire families with a lot of kids, the Watsons and the Parishes and so on, so that he would only have to deal with one of the mothers. So he could fill a whole schoolroom and have only five mothers, and the schoolroom was full of kids. So once he got, once one got to work with him, and this went for stars or crew or Cameron, whatever it is, he liked to keep those people with him. So he would, over a period of years, whenever he would have kid extras, these four or five families would get called. So I met him then, and I knew him for a long time. And then later I was working in The Informer as an extra. And he was a peculiar, strange Irishman, and he never really talked very much to the kids. But he had me do a bit on this. One day we were IRA members, and the next we were the British Black and Tans. He had me do a bit, and he came to me the next day, and he said, I just saw those rushes on that little thing you did yesterday. And he said, you know something, you can't act. And I said, well, Mr. Ford, I was then about 15, I guess. I said, I've been acting for you for a long time. He said, no, but you've never been on the screen for longer than 3 or 4 seconds. Now, in this thing, you are. He said, we got to do something about that. And a couple of days later, he came to me. He said, when you finished on the picture, which was a short, didn't take long to shoot The Informer, he took me to the cutting room to a man named Billy Hamilton and said, Billy, this guy will be better in the cutting room. He's certainly no good in front of the camera. And that's how I got in the cutting room.
Yeah. What was your first lesson with him, though, when you were in the cutting room? I remember you saying something about him saying to you, come over here, stand next to this camera. I want to tell you a little something about how it goes.
Oh, well, that was after I was a sound effects cutter working at Fox. And I used to sneak on the stage and hang around and see, watch him, because I wanted to be a director. And so one day I went on, they were shooting, I forget what it was, but he asked the assistant director, his brother, to bring me over, and he had a finder. The finder on a motion picture camera is a piece, practically a piece of steel about 2.5 feet long. It's really the lens, except you can take it off the camera and look through it and see what you're going to shoot. And so he was looking through this, getting ready to make his setup on the scene. And he said, "That you, Parrish?" I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "You're standing close enough to hear me talk?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, you asked me a couple of years ago about how to be a director. Here's your first lesson." He said, "Get behind this thing and put it over both your eyes and start thinking. And think about what you're going to shoot, because most of the times you come in the morning, you don't know what you're going to shoot. And while you're thinking, time will go on, and somebody, some stooge on the set, will phone the front office and say it's 9:30 and he hasn't got a shot yet. And then somebody from the production office will come down, and he'll stand just about where you're standing." And I stood there. I was taking in all this, and he said, "When you're sure he's very close, you swing the finder around hard," which he did, and he hit me in the forehead and broke the skin. And he said, "Don't take your eyes from behind it. Just say you're still working and looking around." And he said, "They won't come back anymore." He said, "That's your first lesson. Get the hell back in the cutting room where you belong."
And you stood there bleeding?
I was bleeding, and I went up to the first aid place. And I will say that I was working on sound effects. Then he came in the back door. I had was working late. And on that day, and I had a bandage on my head, and he came to the back of the cutting room and stood there for a while. And he said, "Are you having trouble with that sequence?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He said, "Then you're doing it wrong." He said, "The way I shoot stuff, it fits. You don't have to cut it. You just splice it together." And he turned around and walked about away.
My guest is Robert Parrish. He grew up in Hollywood, appeared in films as a child, and went on to win an Oscar for his editing of the film Body and Soul. He's written 2-volume memoirs, Growing Up in Hollywood and Hollywood Doesn't Live Here Anymore. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Director, film editor, and actor Robert Parrish is my guest. You know, when you tell that story about John Ford, and I think of the stories about some of the other old Hollywood directors, what is it about them that seem to have this ability to, almost an exquisite ability, to dismiss people?
Well, yes, that's part of the job, but you see, my experience was that all Hollywood directors are different, that there are no two alike. William Wyler was not like von Sternberg, and Ford certainly wasn't like anybody else. And so they can dismiss people, but they do it in different ways. I remember William Wyler was asked to come to USC Film School and talk to the students, and he was then the top director in Hollywood, I guess, one of the top. So he called me because I'd been to school at USC, and he said, "Now, what are these kids going to ask me?" And I said, "Well, they'll ask you a lot of stuff, but finally, one of them will say, how do you become a director? That's the key to the whole thing. Then you have to think of what to say." Mm-hmm. So Willie said, "Will you come with me?" And I said, "Yes." I went there, and they asked questions, and I sat in the front row. And finally, a Burmese boy got up in the back and said, "Mr. Wyler, my question is, how do you become a director?" And Willie looked at me, and he smiled, and he said, "I can't tell you how other people became a director, because all directors are different. I'll tell you my experience, and you probably can get something from that that will help you become a director." And they all said expectantly. He said, "First, be born in Alsace-Lorraine." He said, "Second, preferably in the city of Maloose." He said, "Then, and third, this is very important, listen carefully, have an uncle who owns Universal Pictures in California." Then he said, "You write him a letter." And he said, he won't answer it. Then you go to your mother and say, will you call your brother at Universal Pictures and ask if I can come out and work in the studio, which she did. Then you'll get a kind of a steerage ticket. And when you meet your uncle in Universal Studio, he will say, you now owe us so much money, and we'll pay you $10 a week until you've paid that off, and you can sleep behind the prop shop. And he said, you're in the studio then. The most important thing is to get your foot in. He said, after that, just a question of being lucky for the rest of your life. Well, these kids sat there. But I remember that because his point was that every director did it differently, and they fired people. He dismissed these kids with this story. That's dismissal, if I ever heard one.
It's a great story. Yeah. You know, when I think about Ford again, he made some of the greatest Hollywood films. But there was this story about him that he almost never moved the camera. So was that part of his genius?
I don't know if it was his genius. It was his way of shooting a picture. He was not a man for any mysteries about technique. He's the first person I ever saw who was shooting a scene with Ward Bond. And he at a certain point, he said, keep the camera rolling, and he put his hand in front of the camera. And so Ward Bond went on talking. And what he meant was, to the cutter, this was a signal, don't use whatever this, because Ward is lousy in this part of it. And then he'd take his hand away when he thought Ward was good. Now, that was complete control of the mechanics, and his pictures were shot with very little footage. There was very little left over.
Now, how about you when you first started directing? Were you scared the first time?
Oh, yes. Dick Powell, the actor, gave me a chance to direct a melodrama that he wanted to do. And I went to see him, and I said, you know, I've never directed anything before. And he said, there's nothing to it. He said, even I could do it. But he said, I'm so busy playing the stock market and doing other buying real estate, I haven't got time. He said, you just come on there, pretend you know what you're doing, and I'll pretend I know you know what you're doing, and we'll make the picture. And we did. And it was a modest success, but at least I was then a director.
How often did you bring your films in on budget?
Most all the time. One that kind of got away was Casino Royale, which was I didn't direct it. I directed a section of it. They decided to make a James Bond picture with a new director and a new James Bond in each section. And John Huston had David Niven as his James Bond. I had Peter Sellers, but I also had Orson Welles as Smersh, and they hated each other. And Orson was good in the morning and no good in the afternoon, for whatever reason. As soon as Peter heard this, he had his agent come in and say, I can really only be good in the ass. So the picture closed down. And so that one went over budget, way over budget.
Director, film editor and actor Robert Parrish is my guest. Did that happen often? Did you, on any other occasions, have, leading people who were not speaking to each other?
Well, there's little things in every movie, I guess, that some people don't get along.
How do you get them to work together, though?
Well, in that case, I had to agree. Peter said he wouldn't come back on the set if he had to speak to Orson Welles, and they had long scenes together. So I had to devise ways where Schmersh would be sitting up behind a wall talking to James Bond. That was the worst. That's the worst job, that I ever ran across, of trying to... Actually, Orson was marvelous, and Peter was a peculiar, talented, funny man, but he was strange.
Now, when you got the Academy Award for Body and Soul in 1947, I was thinking about that, and I wondered if you felt the pressure, as some people do, to try and do it again, to get another Academy Award.
Well, of course, I was delighted to win the Academy Award, but I didn't... I kind of thought that it was that I'd get one every year. I never got another one, but I did, of course, aim to try to do the best work I could. And the following year, I was nominated for a movie called All the King's Men, but I didn't win it. And that disappointed me because I thought the cutting job on that was much better than the one on The Body and Soul. So I don't think that it's necessary to. It's a very hard thing to judge, and a lot of things are involved in it.
When you were directing in the 1950s, and the House Un-American Activities Committee was in full swing, did that make life difficult for you?
Well, it wasn't a happy time for anybody, but. I was, I guess, apolitical. I was so busy trying to get ahead and to cut pictures and to get jobs that I wasn't really aware as I should have been at the beginning of the period. I did become aware when they had a big sort of scandalous meeting of the Directors Guild. It was the first one that I attended as a member of the Directors Guild, where Joe Mankiewicz and Cecil B. DeMille had a battle, and they were extreme opposites politically. And DeMille wanted to get rid of Mankiewicz. He was president of the Guild, and all kinds of people got up and gave speeches and tears. And Reuben Mamoulian said, "This is the first time I've been embarrassed to be an American." And one kid said, "I worked for Mr. DeMille since I was a kid, and unless he takes this back and what he said about Joe Mankiewicz, I'm leaving the Guild," and all that. Finally, John Ford got up, chewing his handkerchief, and said, hadn't said a word to the whole meeting, which had lasted over 3 hours. And he said, "I know that Cecil B. DeMille knows more about what to show people to get them into the theater than anybody in this room, and I respect him for that. He's a fine filmmaker." But he said, "I don't like you, C.B." The room came to a dead stop. And he said, "I think you've maligned Joe Mankiewicz tonight, and I hereby move that you resign from the board of the Guild." Matter of fact, he said, "I think we all should resign and start over." And that's a motion, and it was carried. So then I knew that there were strong differences of opinion politically, and a lot of careers were ruined. And I think now, as I look back on it, it was shocking.
I've enjoyed this time together so much. Thank you so much.
I have too. Thank you.
My guest has been Robert Parrish. His memoirs are titled Growing Up in Hollywood and Hollywood Doesn't Live Here Anymore. They're published by Little Brown. I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Edmund White. He's written autobiographical novels about coming of age as a gay man in America. As a journalist, he's written about gay issues and reported from Paris for Vogue magazine. Hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. I'm sitting in for Terry Gross, who's on vacation. Coming up, I speak with Peter Phillips, director of the Renaissance choral group The Talus Scholars. Their records and performances provide 20th century listeners with a glimpse of the Renaissance. Mac Rebenack, better known as Dr. John, is back in our weekly performance spot. Today, he plays a few tunes by Louis Armstrong. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews Anything Goes. Cole Porter's hit play is back on Broadway, starring Patti LuPone. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. The Pentagon says 1,300 additional U.S. troops are being ordered to Panama. In a statement released this evening, the Pentagon said the deployment comes in response to increasing instability in Panama and the potential threat to U.S. citizens and other interests there. Administration officials with President Reagan in California insist the deployment is not an offensive against the military regime of General Manuel Noriega. Before flying to California for his 10-day Easter vacation, President Reagan today signed a nearly $50 million aid bill for the Contras in Nicaragua. NPR's Brian Naylor has details.
The president signed the aid plan without fanfare in the residence of the White House this morning. The $47.9 million package will provide humanitarian support for the rebels as they begin to implement their ceasefire with the Nicaraguan government. The plan also contains a method for the White House to request military aid for the Contras should the peace process break down. Mr. Reagan is not expected to emerge from his ranch in the mountains near Santa Barbara except to attend a fundraiser Monday in Newport Beach, south of Los Angeles, for his presidential library. I'm Brian Naylor in Washington.
His spirits lifted by the announcement that an independent counsel is not seeking his indictment at this time. Attorney General Edwin Meese today told reporters at the Justice Department that he will stay on the job for as long as the president wants him to.
If a person has to step aside merely on the basis of some allegation, however false, then it would be easy for unscrupulous persons to make allegations and therefore literally cause people to step aside and move out of their offices.
Independent counsel James McKay said today that so far there is not enough evidence to indict Meese for his involvement in a complicated deal to build an oil pipeline in Iraq. Meese was also asked today about the resignations of two of his top aides earlier this week. He refused to comment, saying only that he would announce their replacements early next week. The nation's jobless rate fell again last month. The Labor Department reports a 0.1% decline in March. Michael Richards has details.
An increase in service jobs and construction work helped nudge the unemployment rate down to 5.6%. That's the lowest it's been in almost 9 years. But in testimony before the Congressional Joint Economic Committee today, the Commissioner of Labor Statistics, Janet Norwood, said part of the reason joblessness has declined so consistently lately is that fewer people are out looking for their first jobs.
As we've often discussed, the dramatic surge of women's labor force participation took place in the 1960s and the 70s. Although women are continuing to enter the labor force in large numbers, the rate of their increase has slowed. In addition, the birth rate decline in the 60s and early 70s has resulted in fewer young people reaching labor force age in the 80s.
Usually, fewer available workers means higher pay for those on the job, but that hasn't happened yet. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards on Capitol Hill.
The Reagan administration is still not satisfied with the compromise trade bill drafted by Congress. Presidential spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says major changes must be made in the bill, or the president will veto it. Several of the provisions in the bill, such as a rule that companies would have to give advance notice to close down a plant and sanctions against the Toshiba Corporation of Japan, are offensive to the administration. House and Senate negotiators did get rid of one provision the administration doesn't like. The Gebhardt Amendment would have required retaliation against countries that run excessive trade surpluses with the U.S. Instead, the congressional conferees crafted a measure that gives the president more latitude to decide whether or not to retaliate. Whirlpool Corporation announced today that it has reached an agreement with General Electric Company, ending their battle to acquire the Roper Corporation. Under the agreement, Whirlpool will drop its bid for Roper, allowing GE to get Roper's stove and lawn equipment plants. Whirlpool will receive the Roper brand name for large appliances. Whirlpool also sells appliances under the KitchenAid name. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Over the past few weeks, we've had the pleasure of presenting the rolling piano and gravelly voice of Mac Rebenack, also known as Dr. John the Night Tripper. On today's performance spot, Mac continues his tribute to New Orleans, where he grew up and discovered his earliest musical inspirations.
It'd be very hard to do anything about New Orleans music without talking about Satchmo, Louis Armstrong, the guy that kind of put the jazz on the map, and do a couple of his little tunes when we're starting out with Basin Street. Now won't you come along with me down to Mississippi? We'll take a boat to land of dreams, a heaven on earth, they call it New Orleans. Talking about Basin Street is a street where all the light and the dark force meet. Yeah, really mean, never know how much it means when you wait outside the New Orleans. And we'll take a plane to the land of dreams. I'm talking about a heaven on earth. They call it Basin Street. Yeah, that's a little Louis Armstrong stuff. Not too much in the vein a little, but you know, you can't get away from your stuff no matter what you do. And one of the songs I always used to love as a child by Lou was a thing called Mississippi Mud. And it goes something like this. Mississippi Mud, or as we like to say in Louisiana, Mississippi Mud. But Louis always had that taste for stuff that gut bucket blues and made him so pretty. And one of my real all-time favorites was his version when he got back and played the stuff like C.C. Ryder and those real back-in-the-alley blues, because he was a back-of-town cat. What we call New Orleans, Gert Town, back of town. And that was his real forte, playing the blues. And this is one of my real all-time favorites called C.C. Ryder. C.C. Ryder. See you what you done done. CC Rider, see what you done done. You know your man don't love you. Now your lover's gone.
Rebenack will be back over the next few weeks. A collection of work, The Ultimate Dr. John, has just come out on compact disc. This is Fresh Air. This week, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviewed the recordings of the English choral group The Tallis Scholars. They specialize in early music. Now, many of you were intrigued. We got lots of calls asking us about their current U.S. tour. Today, in hopes of satisfying some of your curiosity and mine, my guest is Peter Phillips, founder and director of The Tallis Scholars. Phillips formed the group 10 years ago with high hopes of creating a nearly pure vocal sound. Here are The Tallis Scholars singing Allegri's Miserere, written in the 17th century and performed in the Sistine Chapel during Holy Week. When was the first time you heard early church singing?
Well, I was a chorister at Winchester Cathedral. I was brought up in the tradition of singing this music. But I didn't hear it sung quite like this, as we do it, with a professional adult choir, until I went to Oxford University. Then I heard it on a group called the Clerks of Oxenford. And they sent me into a daze which lasted for weeks.
You started out playing the oboe, and then you switched to the organ, and there was a little piano in there. How did you make your way to a choir?
In England, it's necessary to play the organ in order to become a cathedral musician, in order to conduct a choir.
Oh.
That's the standard route. I don't know whether it's the same here. So I had to take up the organ, really. I didn't enjoy it very much.
You were bad at it?
I was not good at it. It was a trial.
So the choir was a relief?
Oh, well, right from the beginning, it was just what I wanted. I mean, I wanted to explore repertoire and mould the sound of singers right from the beginning, the moment I heard it, in fact.
Well, where did you develop that sense of just knowing that the sound was right as a conductor?
Well, as I say, I heard it first on a choir called the Clerks of Oxenford, and there were some imperfections in that sound. In fact, the sound is always slightly imperfect, which is one of the exciting things about it. I listened to our records, which I think probably come the nearest, because all the imperfections have been removed, so far as that's possible, by the conditions of the recording. But there's usually something comes along to disrupt the flow for me. I hope it doesn't for other people.
As you conduct, what are you after? Can you find words to describe that purest sound you imagine?
Well, it starts, I think, with the balance between the voices. The purity is has to be affected by nobody actually sticking out, and this is a genuinely choral sound. So you're trying to get, in my case, 10 singers, normally 10, to sound like an instrument, but an instrument of voices. So they have to be very, very aware of what everyone else is doing.
And they have to be people, I would imagine, who don't want a solo career.
Well, that's a very interesting question. A lot of them do have solo careers, but when they come to sing for me, they have to forget themselves and become part of a team.
The Agnus Dei from Josquin, it's so beautifully done by you. Now, as I listen to it, I wonder if it's harder to sing soft than it is to sing loud.
It depends on the kind of voice. If it's a very highly trained voice, it will have been encouraged to sing out in order to fill a hall with the sound. And they will find it difficult to sing softly, yes. But if one's trying to create an ethereal effect, I don't think loud singing is quite what's wanted. The angels probably don't shout at each other.
Do you feel spiritual or holy when you conduct?
Not necessarily. Depends where the concert's taking place, actually. We sing about half of our time in churches and the rest of the time in concert halls. If the sound is really spot on and we're in a beautiful Gothic building with a lovely altarpiece, which I can see, but the singers can't because we tend to sing with our backs to the altar, then I do feel spiritual, yes. But I didn't, for instance, when conducting in the Sydney Opera House.
Do you ever wish you were born in another time?
I often think about it. I'm particularly attracted to the 16th century, but I'm perfectly happy where I am. I mean, I wouldn't have had such a good choir in the 16th century, I don't think.
Why not?
Well, there were just many fewer singers to choose from. I'm sure that the strength of the English singing at the moment is results from the number of good singers there are in London. And I just have an enormous pool of singers to choose from. It's a great luxury.
Are you strict about your musical interpretations of this music? I mean, is it important for you to do it exactly as it was done 300 years ago?
No. I carefully avoid being pedantic about authenticity. What concerns me is always to produce a lively performance at the time. The debate is much more fierce over instrumental playing, which doesn't concern me.
Yeah.
Because instruments have been discovered and all, but you can't discover a voice from the 16th century. So we escape, actually, quite a lot of trouble. But I'm careful to read all the scholarly articles and then ignore them if necessary.
Now, women weren't in the original church choral groups. What's your thinking on that? You have women in your choir.
Well, that's quite straightforward. We couldn't. There's a practical point here that we simply couldn't tour in the way we're doing here in America with boys. But also, actually, I've come to prefer the sound that the women make to the sound that boys could possibly make. The women that we use often sound like, they're said to sound like boys, but actually I think they sound much nicer.
Now, was this music written originally to account for the echo in the church? I mean, did the space shape the composition?
I personally think that it did. I think that the slow move, the best composers, and Palestrina is the obvious example, had a very good sense of how to fill a large reverberant building with sound that everyone could hear. That's to say, his lines move slowly and deliberately. Nothing startling happens without careful preparation. It's ideally suited to a big building. I was brought up in Winchester Cathedral, which is one of the very largest, and I got used to the music that sounded well in there. And by and large, that's my favourite repertoire now.
Is there a dream cathedral you'd like to perform in?
From an acoustical point of view, there isn't really. I feel it's part of our professional job just to produce a really good sound anywhere. But if you, in an honest answer to your question is that I want to perform in St. Basil's Cathedral, Moscow.
Why?
Because it sounds such an exciting building, and it's such a difficult place to get to.
Peter Phillips is the director and founder of the Talis Scholars. The group begins its U.S. tour April 2nd at Stanford University. The cities they'll visit include Los Angeles, Seattle, Evanston, Boston, New York, Pittsburgh, and Philadelphia. They record on their own label called Gimmel. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in now with co-host Robert Siegel to find out what's going on. What do you have?
Hello, Faith. We're following Attorney General Meese's efforts to replace the high-ranking Justice Department aides who resigned this past week. Not much success yet in getting those names made public, but apparently he's trying. Also, we check in on the trade bill. It has been shorn of the Gebhardt Amendment, and we'll hear from former presidential candidate, Representative Richard Gebhardt, about that development. We're working on, a very explosive story about what may be the biggest Canadian investment, yet the biggest purchase of property in this country ever by Canada.
Interesting. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic at large Laurie Stone has some thoughts on a revival of Cole Porter's musical Anything Goes. 54 years after it was written, she says, it's still the tops.
Cole Porter was an upper-class kid who knew if he stayed among his own, he'd get nowhere in life. So he went into theater. For him, that was healthy slumming. For the theater, it was icing, because Porter was hip at a time when hip meant elegant. Never mean-spirited, but always puncturing manners, Porter's caricatures are closer to Al Hirschfeld's than Hogarth's. And the chic braininess and hodgepodging of classes that defined his style fly breezily in Lincoln Center's version of Anything Goes. The production, starring Patti LuPone of Evita fame, has been a smash hit since the fall, but it's still one of the most satisfying evenings on the New York boards. First, there are the songs, a cornucopia of great tunes written in 1934 that have become part of our consciousness. I Get a Kick Out of You, You're the Top, Easy to Love, Friendship, It's Delovely, Blow Gabriel Blow, and the sublimely naughty Anything Goes. Occasioning the numbers is one of those loose musical comedy plots set aboard an ocean liner involving separated lovers, mistaken identities, stowaways, and unlikely couplings. The ship is the world detached from the social rules that usually keep people apart. Low class and high class, sinners and clergy, crooks and cops, Asians and Westerners. On the boat, anything goes, literally, the only important division being between fun-loving people and spoil sports. At the last minute, Charlie Chaplin cancels his trip, so to replace him as ship celebrity, the captain happily enlists Moonface Martin, who is public enemy number one. Reno Sweeney, a nightclub chanteur, played by Lupone, provides the entertainment. For her big number, she conducts a mock religious service and at once satirizes the showbiz side of the church and the evangelical side of entertainment. By the end of the play, all boundaries have been invaded. With the exception of the dancers wearing jingle taps on their shoes, which create a racket rather than crisp sounds, the production, played on sleek Art Deco sets, is full of clever staging. The most stirring feature of the show is Lupone's musical, seductive performance. Porter created the part of Reno Sweeney for Ethel Merman, who, without a mic, belted Blow Gabriel Blow loud enough for the archangel himself to hear. Lupone is equally full-throated and lusty, but she has her own jazzy phrasing and a subtler, sexier manner than Merman's. Anything Goes evokes the past that gave birth to our own age of jumbled signs, the age born of mass media and advertising, where, on the downside, it doesn't matter what you're famous for, as long as you're notorious, and, on the upside, where reporters consult street people about homelessness. When Cole Porter arouses nostalgia, it's for the birth of social rebellion, sassiness, and complexity. What a pleasure it is to escape our present time of AIDS hysteria and fears of sex and social change. When Porter opines, the world's gone mad today, and good's bad today, and day's night today, and black's white today, he isn't complaining, but spiritedly celebrating.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic, and she's a contributor to The Village Voice.
The world has gone mad today, and good's bad today, and black's white today, and day's night today, when most guys today that women prize today are just silly gigolos. And though I'm not a great romancer, I know that I'm bound to answer when you propose.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. On the next show, I'll speak with festival planner Marilyn Wood. Using dance, film, sound, and light, Wood designs celebrations of the urban environment. If the celebrations go as she plans, the city will never see itself the same way again. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review a recording featuring South African saxophonist Dudu Bukwana and the quintet Spear. And television critic David Biancooley will review Thy Kingdom Come, Thy Will Be Done, a PBS special on the fundamentalist movement. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Faith Middleton. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.